really give an honest talk. So the way I should be thinking about this talk is me trying, I mean struggling to pass some kind of qualifying exam on the subjects that essentially David, Kevin, and Hirako taught me during more or less the last year. So basically, all the members of my PhD committee are present in the room. And so let's see if I manage to. But of course, you know, since I'm not a very good student, I'll try to reform everything they taught me in my own language, and we'll see. So what is the subject? So the subject for me is basically, you know, big subject is how to think about what actually Hirako mentioned. He's talking about 3D chemical flow. Symmetric quantum theory, I would say in mathematical, or I would even say strongly in algebraic terms. So somehow, when you think about quantum field theories, you know, it has some kind of, sometimes it has some analytic structures which I can won't completely ignore, but I will talk about algebraic terms. And here, my talk will consist of such two parts. So the first part will be, so to say, simple stuff. Simple things. And here, in particular, I'm going to basically give a brief recap of what Hirako talked about. So this was about sort of his and then there will be kind of upgrade, which in the physics language will have to do with the notion of holomorphic twist. Mathematically, it will be formulated in the language of E1 chiral algebras with additional structure. And I mean, I haven't done my homework completely, but at least partly, I will try to explain, the correct words here, and I will try to say how we can get one from two. Okay, that's what I want to try to. Yes, and maybe it will be part three. In particular, there will be some kind of one very particular theory. That has already been mentioned in this workshop many times. This is the theory T of G, and I will try to say what, in this language, what this theory has to do with something related to geometric language correspondence. So in fact, it will be, for me, it will be some kind of quasi-classical version of geometric language. Okay. Now let me try to do one. So somehow, okay. So so again, following Hirako, I'm going to talk about this theories now. Well, let me denote this theory, but so T will mean this theory. Now, what kind of mathematical objects do you want to attach? In this kind of simple part, we're going to attach to this modular space of Mako, and in fact, we're going to attach to it we're going to study some particular parts of this modular space of Mako. So this will teach us that we're supposed to attach two spaces, MH and MC, which for me will be complex Poisson generically symplectic varieties. So in all the examples I'll be talking about, they'll be affine, although from the physical perspective that's actually not necessary. So we can actually start, for example, we can actually, for any holomorphic symplectic manifold, to any holomorphic symplectic manifold, as far as I understand, you're supposed to be able to attach such a theory such that its Higgs branch will be this holomorphic symplectic manifold. That's kind of mathematical structure. Now, what kind of operations do we have on theories? This is what Hirako basically explains. So, operations on theories. First operation is really, as Hirako explained, the product. So T1, T2, this is supposed to attach T1 two. And on the level of these guys, this just corresponds to taking their product. So somehow it just corresponds to this yield product. That's one thing. Now, another operation, which was also mentioned by Hirata, was near 3D near asymmetry. Which I'll denote by T going to T star. This just interchanges MC and H. And so far, this is just words. Now, next thing, next notion is really, I mean, which also is very close to what Hirata explained, is the notion of symmetry. So then this notion of group G, so this is a notion of G, group G, which I'll think about as, for now, as reductive algebraic group, G acting on a theory. And what does it amount to? So how can we see this on this level? Well, what this should yield? This should yield two things. This should yield G action on M H, and that's kind of one thing. And B, okay. So here to say this, I really need to assume that I'm in the affine situation, which is kind of similar in general case. So here. What kind of data does this symmetry imply on the Coulomb side? On the Coulomb side, this implies that this should yield this object. So this is what Hirata mentioned about ring object A equal T on the affine Grassmannian of G check. So ring object in the derived Sataki in, well, let me say in derives a type of category of G-check. Such that it's Schwiegstock one is functions of this one.
Can I ask a small question?
Yes.
You talk about M Higgs and M Coulomb.
Yes.
But in general, there are mixed branches.
Sure. Well, that's. You know, that's probably going to be one of the points where I'm going to fail with my qualifying exam, so because I don't have, at this point, I don't know how to think about the full modular space in a good way. I mean, in principle, you're completely right that there should be, and in fact, somehow here, I will try to say some kind of much richer algebraic structure, which you should be able to dash to this theory, and from that much richer algebraic structure, in principle, should be able to read off the full modular space. But I don't know how, even after I say what this richer structure is, I still don't know how to read off this. Okay. Now, just okay. So this is the. This is the data. Now, another part four, another operation is that still, if G acts on theory T, this is also what Hirata also mentioned. This you should be able to attach to this data T and G a new theory, which is called sort of. You can in the physics language, you can gauge the symmetry, so gauge the symmetry. And this is the notation for this. And the reason for this notation is that if you look at the Higgs branch of the gauge theory, then this is supposed to be the Hamiltonian reduction of the Higgs branch of the original theory by G. And if you look at the Coulomb branch, then something more interesting. Well, I mean, so on the level of Coulomb branch, the symmetry realizes itself but as some kind of more complicated structure. And so if you want, so again, I'm now assuming that all these guys are fine. Otherwise, somehow the story becomes more complicated. So so MC, this is going to be the spec of the cohomology, geophilic cohomology of this. Okay, so that's part four. Now here already, I want to say that somehow, I mean, what I have already said allows you to construct a lot of theories in the following way. So one sort of basic piece of structure is that if you start with some X, which is say, let's set a fine symplectic generically, a fine sort of Poisson, generically symplectic, then to this thing you're supposed to be able to assign a theory, some T sub X, such that its Higgs branch is equal to X and its Coulomb branch is a point. But if G X on X, then G should act on G should act on T sub X. And then again, for example, gauge it, and then already and then you get already a lot of theories. So for example, you can start with X being a symplectic vector space. If X is a symplectic vector space and G acts on X linearly, well, I mean, G should act on X, in a Hamiltonian way, so Hamiltonian, actually. On X linearly, the corresponding theory sort of Tx with gauge G. So this is what physicists usually call gauge theories, which those can be written down by Lagrangian. And what Hiraku explained basically that at least when X can be written as quotient bundle of something else, where Y is also some kind of G representation, then in this case, MC and the corresponding ring objects, and the AT and so on, are constructed in our papers with Finkelberg and Nakajima. Okay, so that's so this way you get sort of at least some supply of theories. Now there's one more example which was also mentioned by Hiraku and by many other people. This is the theory T of G. So T of G is the theory which sort of the most mysterious property of it is that it has an action. So this should be case number five. There should be some theory which are called T of G. And so this is some theory which has, so it has the following property. It has G times G check symmetry, where G check is the Lagrange dual group. And here M H is the Nilpotent column of G. This is Neil Coulomb in the Lyapunov of G. And M Coulomb is supposed to be the Nilpotent column of G check. And again, so far, we don't really have tools to say in what sense the theory exists, because we haven't said yet anything about what theory means, except that we should have these objects, yes.
So in the language you're using until now, G-check would not be a symmetry, it would be a symmetry of the dual?
Yes, right, so, sorry. Yes, I'm a little bit, yes, I'm jumping a little bit. It has G-symmetry. Yes, and you're right. It should have the property that T of G star is supposed to be the same as T of G check. So in particular, you see that this guy is supposed to be also the Higgs branch of this, and so it does have an action of G-check. And also, I mean, Hirata explained what are the corresponding ring objects. So here the corresponding ring object AT, this is the this is actually, in this case, it's a perverse sheaf. That's actually a rare situation. It's perverse sheaf on group G, which corresponds on the Sapakian equivalence to the regular representation of G-chain, the functions on G-chain. So that's the theory TOG. And maybe the last piece of structure I want to mention, which kind of relates it to Lennon's correspondence and to also to sort of what envisioned physics language is realized by means of path duality. So this is related to the work of Gagliotti and Wiener from 10 years ago. So suppose you have a theory T which has a this G symmetry, then you can think about this theory essentially as a boundary condition for a four-dimensional gauge theory for G. And then you can apply S duality. So somehow then you're supposed to be able to construct some theory T dual, which is supposed to have an action of G-check. And in fact, Gagliotti and Wiener wrote a formula for this guy in terms of all the previous data. And the formula for this is the following. The T-dual is equal to the following. So you take T multiplied by T of G. Then you take Hamiltonian reduction by the diagonal copy of G. And then you take mirror dual. This is the right formula.
Yes.
Okay. So this is diagonal. So it's a kind of property of this T of G, essentially, that this thing acquires an action of G. And note that in terms of this Higgs and Coulomb branch, if we know everything about T, and if we know everything about T, then we can actually, I mean, this is what this does, the Higgs and Coulomb branch is somehow completely determined by what's written on the board. So we can actually, okay, so that's kind of the structure. That's the structure you want to see. And in fact, you want to have a richer structure, which would be implied by this. So this is what I will try to explain next. Before that, maybe, I'm just thinking, maybe I want to say one thing about this T of G. So in general, it's kind of pretty mysterious. So we said that we do have some kind of way of thinking about theories, which sort of you get from here when you start with some kind of, say, symplectic vector space, or just symplectic variety, and then just with some action of the group, then we can gauge this group and so on. So in general, it's not of this time, unless G is GLM. So if G is GLM, or SLM, you can actually, this theory, T of G, can actually be obtained by using this procedure. And namely, but for, it will be for the following gauge group. So you can see the G gauge, which will be product from I, but this will be really GLM specific, so GLI. And then we can see that, so in Hirata's notation, representation m, which is just summation I from 1 to n minus 1, all from ci to ci plus 1. This has a natural action of this group. And note that it also has an action of GLM, which is not included in this group, but this GLM will be symmetry of this theory. And then you can see that it's cotangent bundles, so you can see the n plus n star. You can see the sort of, in my notation, you can see the tn plus n star. And then u engage this guy. And this is supposed to be t of g. So one way this manifests itself is in the form of Hirata wrote that this kind of
ring object corresponding to a regular representation on the Fine Grassmannian of GLM can be written as direct image of dualizing sheaf on the space R sub M, R sub GM for this G and for this M. But in other cases, somehow, apparently there's no way to write this. I mean, it doesn't have a branch description, so we can do this.
Type D.
Well,
so
I mean,
less well behaved. Okay.
Yeah, but you know, it's clear that for general group you can do this. Okay, now, so this is the structure. This is the structure that you want to have, but now we want to have a better structure. And so, unfortunately, I mean, so now what I'm going to tell you is mostly what I learned from Kevin. So I hope you're going to correct all my mistakes.
Or else, yes.
Now we can start part two. So in the physics language, what we are going to say is that three-dimensional equal force and symmetric theory possess a holomorphic twist. We do holomorphic twist, which you can naively think about in the following way. So three-dimensional field theories are things which leave on three manifolds, and in principle, they leave on three manifolds with a matter, holomorphic twist. And then there's a way to make them leave on sort of to have a structure which is less than the matrix. So somehow, I mean, it means that you're going to get theories which are kind of holomorphic in two directions of the topological in the remaining one direction. So for example, you can leave on a thing like Riemann surface with a complex structure times a one manifold. So when you do this holomorphic twist, you lose part of the supersymmetry. Essentially half of the supersymmetry is lost. So some supersymmetry is lost, but some supersymmetry will survive, and then we'll see what it means algebraically. Lost, but some will survive. And so again, this kind of thing that somehow it's kind of holomorphic in two directions and topological in one direction. And so what we know is that one way to construct, if we're not in three dimensions but in two dimensions, and we talk about conformal field theories, which sort of leave on Riemann surface with complex structure, then we know that this thing is very close to vertex separator algebra. So you're supposed to, so roughly speaking, the algebraic structure which is responsible for conformal field theories in two dimensions is the vertex separator algebra. So here, these are things which are kind of homomorphic in two directions and topological. One direction, and so we're actually going to obtain them from vertex algebras with additional structure. So the slogan is, let me write this, and this is kind of the algebraic data you want to associate with. The algebraic way I would like to try to think about here is that this should be obtained from in E1 vertex algebra. Now, what does E1 vertex algebra mean? So you can think about it in several different ways. So E1 basically means that one way to think about it is that it's the same as associative algebra. Well, in effect, you know, when you say these words E1 and 2 and so on, that implicitly means that all your objects are DG objects. That in fact all your objects are complexes and there's some kind of DG thing going on. If you know the DG structure, then somehow things become really much, much simpler. But it's an associative algebra in the category. Of vertex separator algebras. And one way to think about vertex separator algebras in terms of factorization algebras. So you can think about vertex separator algebras as a kind of factorization algebra, which is something which, I mean, if you have a smooth complex curve, then, you know, vertex separator algebra is something means that you can associate on any power of the curve, to any power of the curve, you can associate some coherent Schiffer, in fact, quasi-coherent Schiffer, in fact, a D module. And essentially what E1 means that this G module will fiber-wise have a structure of an associative algebra. And on the I mean, I said that these are all DGU objects, and on the level of cohomology, this will in particular automatically imply that this vertex algebra will become unit. But that's not the whole structure. I said that somehow when we perform this homomorphic twist, you lose part of the supersymmetry. So let me call this algebra. You lose part of the symmetry, part of the supersymmetry, but part of the supersymmetry is still there. Now, how does it come about algebraically? So, I want to say what the structure is going to be, and then I'll try to say in certain examples how you construct such things. So how does supersymmetry manifest itself? Well, if you have a vertex algebra, well, if you look at it as just a vector space, then it has any kind of vertex algebra, by definition, has an action of the positive part of the Virasoro algebra. So this is the same as vector fields on the formal disk. The supersymmetry will manifest itself in saying that this will get upgraded to an action of some superextension of the Virasoro algebra. So supersymmetry means that some superversion, which I'll call S here, once acts. Now, let me say who this guy is, and in fact, this is already quite non-trivial, because it has two definitions, and the equivalence of two definitions is elementary but non-trivial. So in fact, my questions to the physicists and the audience will be for a good reference to this. I was actually able recently to do this exercise myself, but it was very painful. So who is this guy? So one definition is very easy, so let me first work with one definition. So this is algebra of vector field. This is the super algebra of vector fields. This is just vector fields on cisbeck C of Z epsilon, where Z is an even variable and epsilon is odd. It's an odd variable. Z even and epsilon is odd. Now let me first, ignore the second definition, so I'll explain what we need the second definition for. The second definition will be important when you start talking about mirror symmetry. But already, so here,
E squared, you said zero?
I'm sorry?
E squared.
Yes, it's odd, so it's square is equal to zero. But the point is that, you should treat this as a super algebra, so somehow it's really it's Z2 graded, and with the condition that epsilon is odd in particular. This implies that epsilon squared is equal to zero. So one thing that's going to be important for us is that this superalgebra is going to contain two particular odd elements, two particular supercharges, which I'll call Q Higgs and Q Coulomb. And this one is in this coordinates, this is the epsilon d over dz, and this one is d over d epsilon. You can also do the other way around, it's really a matter of normalization. And so one property that you want, sort of not slightly naive property that you want is the following. Let me write it and then I'll make some comment about this. So how is it related to what I talked about in the beginning? So if you take, these are some odd vector fields, and not just odd vector fields, but these are odd vector fields whose square is equal to zero. In particular, you can take whenever the super algebra acts on anything, you can take cohomology. And if you take cohomology, then the structure should be that the cohomology of this V and the differential QH, V sub T, let me say, it should be the same as functions on the Higgs map, the homology of this with respect to that differential, that should be functions in the core. Now, let me make one remark, which I'm not even going to write. This is, in principle, this is slightly naive, so this is probably obviously expectation. This is slightly naive in the following way, that somehow, if you live in the world of DG algebras, then essentially writing an additional differential on DG algebra is the same as writing an infinitesimal deformation. Or a better way to say it is that if you have a deformation of a DG algebra, it particularly induces a differential on it, but it induces much more than just a differential. So in principle, what the kind of beta statement should be that this guy is a DG algebra should have a deformation, which is just this. But in all nice examples, in all examples I know, this kind of degenerates at the first term, so the first differential is ready enough. So you have a deformation, but somehow, a lot of cohomologies, it's just enough to take cohomologies back to the first differential, you already get the first. Because in principle, deformation, it induces the following structure. It induces, if you have a DG algebra, a deformation, it induces your differential on its cohomology, and then induces differential on the cohomology of what you get, and so on. So it uses the same kind of sequence, and in principle, you're supposed to take the whole thing, but for some reason, in all examples I know, they can come on to respect the first differential is already sufficient. So let me just put it in the board. I'm sorry?
This is a sort of general question, which is that of course, the cohomology of a DG object, the DG object itself might not be formal, and one thing that could happen is the cohomology might have sort of messy products.
Sure,
does that ever occur in the examples?
Yeah, this is another point where I'm probably going to fail my qualifying exams. The answer is I don't know. Do you have any opinion on this?
I think it does. Well, I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, my advisor says it does. So this is kind of the first piece of the structure that you want. And for gauge theories, I'm going to tell you conjecturally the construction of this thing. I'll tell it to you a little later. Now, or maybe I also want to talk about this notion of C. Well, you know what? Let me actually tell you now, then I'll talk about C. So, in particular, I mean, the idea is that this I wanted to first talk about the other definition of the supergrossori, what's needed for. So, one thing that I promised is the mirror symmetry. And mirror symmetry. So, what is it? What should it do on the level of this vertex algebra? Well, it sort of should do nothing. Well, in the following sense, that if you have some theory and dual theory, then this vertex algebra should be just equal. But what should be happening is the following. So the claim is that this supergrossori algebra, so this is a lemma, is that this supergrossori algebra has an involution, which you can write down by existing formulas. I won't do this, but I'll leave this with an exercise. This is actually a simpler part of the exercise. This S here plus has an involution called sigma. So sigma of QC is equal to H. So this should be true up to sigma. Now, a warning is that you kind of, well, I mean, it's slightly maybe misleading to write it in this way, because you sort of, usually when people think about the vertex operator algebra, then, this action of the Virasoro algebra is part of the vertex operator algebra structure. And this really has to, if you want to put it on a curve, this is important how this Virasoro algebra acts, right? So now this sigma does not, well, I mean, the way I wrote it, it's kind of clear that this guy, that this is a super extension of the usual, well, positive part of the Rossora. Just, you know, just ignore epsilon, and so this just contains the usual part of the Rossora. This thing is not invariant on the sigma. So this thing actually contains two different copies of the Vir plus inside, which are interchanged by this evolution sigma. So therefore, when I'm writing this like this, it's like, I mean, they're going to be the same as vector spaces. But and also with this kind of OPE is going to be the same, but the action of Vir plus is going to be different because they're going to be the changements. Now, instead of writing a formula for this guy, let me here's where I want to recall the second definition of Vir plus. Maybe it's a side remark, but it's actually, you know, when you're trying to pass an exam, you usually kind of psychologically mention the things which are difficult for you, that's and this is where, well, at least where you had trouble. So here's the thing where I had trouble to understand this kind of in a nice way. So another definition of this SVR plus. Is the following. So let's consider similar thing, but let's consider the spec of C Z epsilon 1, epsilon 2. So let's now have two odd variables. So here this Z is even and epsilon 1, epsilon 2 are odd. So, well, we can also consider vector fields here. Of course, it's going to be something much bigger. Now here we can consider two particular. Well, I'm actually going to define some distribution here. So, and in fact, first I'm going to define some particular vector field. So let me define theta I to be the following guy. It's going to be epsilon I times d over dz plus d over d epsilon I. And let L be the odd distribution spanned by theta 1, theta 2. So then, as far as I understand, there's another kind of problem. There's a lemma, but this lemma I can only prove by doing a pretty horrible calculation. Is that this S Vir plus is the same as vector fields on spec Z, Z epsilon 1, epsilon 2, preserving the distribution L. Now, what's good about this lemma is that here, if you believe in this, then this thing obviously has an evolution. There's an evolution of the changing epsilon 1 epsilon 2. So, I mean, my question to, I think, the thesis and the audience is that what's the right reference for this?
I can give you some later.
Okay, great. And, because it really took me like 2 months to prove it. You probably gave this as an exercise in Princeton, and like in this.
No. I don't remember where I learned it from originally. Possibly the Lean. I really don't know, but I can give you all the references I know.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so well, again, this is just as I said, it's side remark, but it's one side remark because this somehow kind of makes this evolution less mysterious. Okay, now I want to talk about the sigma dream in this language, but before I do this, let me actually format some conjectures, which is due to Kevin, about how to construct this in our examples. Well, at least for gauge theorists, there's a conjectural construction. So now let me start with the polling. Let X be a symplectic DG spec. Now, let's not be too scared by these words. Let me give you an example of the main sorts of examples I'm going to work with. So let's suppose that we have this really G is a reductive group, for example. Well, not necessarily reductive, but it might be still the old reductive group. And M is some representation of G, fine dimensional representation. Let's take N plus N star, which is the same as cotangent bundle. Let's consider the Hamiltonian reduction of this guy by G. But let's do it in an honest way. So we have the moment map, which goes from here to G star. And then what I consider is I consider preimage of zero quotient by G. And this is going to be my axis. Now, the point is that it can be both DG and the stack. It can be DG because this moment map might not be flat, so preimage of zero might be DG object. And it's a stack. Well, it's definitely a stack because the stabilizer, because frame principle is 0.0, which always has no trivial stabilizer. But the point is that you can still it's easy to make sense of the statement that this thing is symplectic. So this thing has a non-degenerate. This thing carries non-degenerate closed symplectic. I mean, in particular, you can also, of course, look at the case when G is trivial, so then you get just the star family. But let's just take this guy. So then to make the conjecture, well, apparently to what I'm saying to be correct, let me make some assumption on X, which will be automatically satisfied in this example. So I'll assume that X is also conical. And conical means that there's a C-star action. C-star acts on X. So it first of all, dilates the symplectic form, so it acts on omega, which is the symplectic form. This kind of a technical assumption, but it looks like it's needed. Symplectic form by standard character. Well, and it contracts all facts to the point, which, of course, for a stack is slightly, I have to say what it means, but let me ignore this for a moment, but it can be said what it means. And definitely, this will be one of the examples. So, somewhere here have a C star action on this T star M, which is just multiplication action. And this thing is the same as n plus n star, and this commutes with the action of G, and so therefore it descends to an action of this guy. I'm sorry?
Do you really need to assume symplectic to testability?
I need symplectic what I'm going to say next. I mean, I need symplectic, to have this action of a supervisor, I need symplectic. I mean, this thing is really symplectic, so it's not Poisson, it's really symplectic.
I'm asking this symplectic vector space is of this form, n plus
n. To define V itself, I mean, you'll see formal for V in a moment, so to define what V is, I don't need symplectic. To say that the car is an action of supervisor algebra, I will need symplectic.
No,
symplectic
these have some differential display.
Symplectic, what? I'm sorry.
Symplectic of this form.
In principle, just symplectic, maybe some kind of a finance assumption might be necessary. No, it doesn't have to go this way. No, you don't need it. So, the conjecture, so then let me say what V is, so definition. V in this case is going to be R home. Well, from so this is going to be from the structure sheaf of X of Z to itself I mean, usually I would be tempted to write X of O here, but unfortunately, I mean, this is a problem that constantly appears in this business, that somehow O usually means here two different things. It means like structure of something, but also means this ring of Taylor series. So for now, let me just use this ring of Taylor series over X round brackets. Now, I should say that this thing, for instance, if, let's ignore this DG and stack apart, suppose that X, for instance, is an algebraic variety, so it's kind of clearly what it means if X is affine. If X is non-affine, this thing is more tricky, but in fact, it makes sense. So this is a work of Kapranov Vassero, who sort of tell you that, I mean, naively, for example, if X is projective, that X square bracket Z is the same as X round bracket Z. But in fact, you can say better things. So for any X, for example, Kapranov Vassero defined some kind of thin scheme, which is going to be formal neighborhood of this guy and this guy. And you can actually, if X is not affine, that's what they can use. But again, in all of these examples, this is not very relevant. So now, one thing you can say is that I mean, if you can make sense of this, the fact that it's an E1 vertex algebra is obvious. Because it's kind of, because, I mean, I said that the way I want to think about vertex algebra is in front of factorization algebras. And this kind of manifestly can be upgraded to factorization algebra. And also, it's manifestly an associative algebra. So, and these things are kind of manifestly compatible. So somehow this is, the fact that this is an E1 vertex algebra, whenever, if you believe that this makes sense, this is clear. Now,
I know you told us already, but what does E1 really mean?
E1 means that, again, E1's vertex algebra just means that it's a vector space, which is vertex algebra on the one hand, and which is also an associative algebra on the other hand, and they're compatible in some way. Now, if this is just a vector space and not a complex, this just means that this is a commutative algebra, nothing else. Here it is a complex manifestly. It is written as a complex, and so it's like, you know, it's a simple but closely related notion is the notion of E2 algebra. So an E2 algebra you can think about it as a vector space which has two multiplications which are compatible in certain ways. So it's an associative algebra in the category of associative algebras, and as Dana told me, it's also important to mention that the unit is the same. Now, if you do it really for vector spaces, you can do an exercise that's the same as commutative algebra. Now, these two multiplications will coincide, and they will both become commutative. That's it, no other structure. If you say it in the world of DG algebras, it's actually not the same thing. You get commutative algebra structure on the Kalman algebra, but you get more.
If this commutative, does vertex physics serve?
It is commutative, yes, because it's E1 vertex algebra. I mean, its cohomology is commutative. That's the thing.
Commutative would mean no singularities in operator products? What does commutative mean?
Yes. In this line, in terms of operator products,
it's commutative. Anyway, that it is. There's an operation indexed by a point in R3, which is holomorphic in Z and locally constant in R. So that implies it can't have any singularities.
That implies what?
It can't have any singularities because any, you know, any function is holomorphic in one direction, constant in the other, has no poles.
But can't you have line operators wrapping the topological disruption then? I don't see how.
If you had a line operator, you could get a non-commutative algebra on that line operator.
So here we are considering local operators in 3D.
Yeah, it's local operators.
Okay, now conjecture is that it has this right supersymmetry, so the Vr plus. And, you know, it obviously has this Vr plus action because, you know, Vr plus is the vector fields on spec C of Z, so it obviously acts on everything. Vr plus action can be upgraded to S Vr plus action. And this conjecture turned out to be its kind of easy. You can write down some explicit formulas for wrapping if you ignore your G problems. So let me not go into this too much, just how you can actually sort of, it's, one way to say is that, I mean, if all DG algebras were formal, then this conjecture would be easy. Because, I mean, but so far, I mean, proving this character is somehow it's something which you couldn't do before. So let me say, easy DG problems. Are ignored. And let me just stress that what's important here is the following, that of course you can write this guy, so here, to write this guy, I'm not using anything on X, but the symplectic structure on X is necessary in order to do this. So this S has to do with the symplectic structure on X.
So are these problems also there just even for this, for example, with N and G?
Yes. Potentially, yes. I mean, there are problems, you have to say something. Now, already here, this implies some very non-trivial things. Somehow, so I mentioned that under mirror symmetry, this V should, well, if you ignore this resurrection, this V should not change. Now, there are cases when you know, so I said that somehow theories that we know explicitly is this, sort of explicitly, is this gauge theory. So in particular, in this case, we know what X is, so we can write this thing. Now, if you take a mirror dual for such theory, typically it's not going to be a theory of this type, but sometimes it is. And when it is, when it is of this type, you get some kind of a very non-trivial statement, at least if you believe in all these theories. So somehow, so if you start with the theory which associated to T, G, to some G and M, its mirror dual is sometimes of the form T, G prime, and prime. And in fact, you know, for example, you can attach the theories to any quiver, and if it's a quiver of finite type A, then this will be. Now, and in this case, but the corresponding axis will be, so I'll give an example in a moment. So this is actually an example which I more or less computed, so that this is an example we talked about last week, and I think I'm not convinced myself that it works there. So here's a very simple example. You can see that the case, example, let's consider the case when G is actually trivial. And let's consider the case when sort of X is just C2 with an obvious symplectic form. And so we can consider this theory corresponding to C2. What is its mirror dual? Its mirror dual in this notation, it corresponds to some theory where the gauge group G is equal to C star. And in the representation is just the kind of standard character. Now, what is our X in this case? In this case, X is the following. So you should means that you should consider the Gaussian bundle to this point one dimensional representation, which is C2. Now here it now has a symplectic form and it has a symplectic C star action. You can see that the movement map for the symplectic C star action. Then we take the inverse of zero, which is just sends x comma y to x times y. And then we consider its image of zero. So this is the case when you don't get, it's not a DG object, it's a flat map. And then consider the quotient is by C star. The state quotient is by C star. And now the claim is that if you consider this R home for this x, it's the same as to consider this R home for this x. And this is actually, I mean, again, I verify this on the level of cohomology. So, I didn't actually kind of ignore it. I mean, I think it's actually formal in this case, but this I didn't check. But in general, lots and lots of examples when somehow you start with something with this form, you get something else with this form. And
And it's absolutely unclear. I mean, and your this DG stack X in both cases kind of they look absolutely different. They have different dimensions. I mean, everything is different. And so it's absolutely unclear where this would fall, where this mirror symmetry formalized in this language will fall from. But okay, so I have to finish. So let me just say a couple of words about symmetry. Now here actually. This is a point when I'm really going to fail my polyfunction exam because this is something which I didn't think through very carefully. So, but so we're gonna just try to guess approximately what you need, guided by this example. So suppose now that we have some group G acting on a theory, how should it manifest itself on the level of this V? And suppose I assume that G has now, well, in this example, that just would mean that essentially G acts on the stack X. Now, let's look what kind of structure should it imply here. Well, one thing which is obvious is that it should imply the action of G square bracket Z on V. So at least G square bracket Z must act on this of T. But you actually can get a better structure. So let's try to act on this thing by G square by G round bracket Z. So of course this structure shift is not stable under that. So we can move this, but to get a different quaternion shifts on this guy by any element of G round bracket C, and then we can consider a home from this thing to itself. So if you think what it means, that in part at least you must get an object of the sort of coherence attack. So you must get it's a quasi coherent shift G equivariant quasi coherent shift. On the affine gross mod G, which is G. Now, in fact, if you think about this a little bit further, you can actually convince yourself it should be not just should have a slightly richer structure. It should live not just on the affine gross mod G, but should live on the potential bound. So if I can upgrade it, I can upgrade it. Still quite a coherent shift, and moreover, it should have, originally we had an algebra, and this algebra, I mean, this thing will still be a sheaf of algebras. In fact, well, let me not use the word vertex here, it should be a sheaf of sort of E1 factorization algebras. I mean, the fine grass minor has by itself the factorization property, so it makes sense to say that what it means to have a sheaf of E1 factorization algebras. Sheaf of E1. That's at least the structure should get. Now the idea is that the way you should be thinking about this is some kind of quasi-classical version of this ring objects I was talking about, because I mean we're talking about quasi-classical ring objects in the drives attack category. If you think about the drives attack category for the D modules, and then sort of consider some kind of quasi-classical limits between the German D modules to, you can try German D modules into quasi-Hessian shift and the Cartesian bundle. This is kind of what's going to be happening. So. This is the data that should give that symmetry should give, and this ring object that Hirata mentioned, which I also mentioned in the beginning, should be obtained by some deformation of this, and this deformation should actually be part of the whole structure. If you formulate the structure of the whole structure of everything correctly, then the deformation should be there. It should be somehow encoded essentially in the superverse.
So the superverse should act on this category as well.
Well, yes. Oh, okay. So
But again, this is the point. This is the point where I'm really thinking my examples. So this is something that you haven't written down. But that's proximal structure. So okay, so mathematically, what I want to like say is that what we can do right now, we can define this thing. You can actually essentially explain where this thing is coming from if you ignore some DG problems. And you know, I also did this exercise, which was for me just speaking trivial, but pretty surprising. And well, and also in certain examples, which I mentioned there, you can actually check that. Once you define that action, you can try to check define action of this guy. You can really try to take cohomology with respect to these two supercharges. And then, in like this gauge theory examples, you have an expected answer. You know, that you're supposed to get functions from either Higgs and Coulomb branch, and it works. Now, and the real challenge now is to define this thing for the theory T of G. And in principle, if G is GLM, I said that this T of G is a gauge theory. So in principle, we have this gives us some kind of recipe, but this gives a kind of unpleasant recipe. But it also should exist for any G. So for any G, should define this V with all the structures. And I probably should stop now. But what I was going to say is that this is what actually David explained to me recently is that you can actually. If you can do this, you can, let me see, just one word. This is the following thing, which we can either believe or that it holds literally on some closed intervals. If you consider the contingent bundle to the affine Grassmannian of G, you can also consider the contingent bundle to the affine Grassmannian of G dual. And inside here, you have some kind of standard variety, so which is, in this case, it's just union of conormal bundles to G of four orbits. And you can see the similar thing here.
Is this the same as the inverse image of the moment map?
I'm sorry?
Is this the same as the zero of the moment map? The G of O action?
Yes. No.
No, okay.
No, just union of the normal bundles. And so there's a kind of conjecture, at least from this loop problem, it should be true that the quasi coherent sheaves on, coherent sheaves on star angle G, this should be equivalent. This is some kind of quasi classical version of something related to local angles, quasi coherent sheaves G check of C. So Dima recently explained to me that he can prove something very close to this. If you believe in this, then it means that, this is supposed to be given by a kernel, and a kernel should be some object which lives on the product of these two guys. And you can actually explain that this object living on the product, you can get this, one of these objects coming from the theory of G. This is where you're getting us too far, so I just wanted to make some connection to Langlands.
Good question, maybe for David or somebody. So if you want to try and guess what T of G was, maybe you have a formula for the character of this human character algebra already. So is there a formula for the character? Like the half index of this.
Right. Yes. Right. So. Or the index.
The index. Sorry. Yes.
So there's an index of these three theories, which I would guess is the character of V.
What?
Of V.
Right. But the question, and I think that what Kevin was asking is, what kind of information about V do we have?
The character.
But what? But you know what this character is?
I think so. It's a big one day. It goes for GLM, but I think.
Okay, for GLM, again, you have a formula for GLM, again, compared to GLM. We don't have a conjectural construction.
I think more general than GLM.
Maybe, let me say, sorry. Let me say one more word, just related to some other things we're discussing in this workshop. So, and this is also what David explained to me yesterday, is that, at least for TOG, I don't know in what generality, this algebra that I was talking about should actually be written as Hochschild cohomology of some other vertex algebra, some computer. And this other vertex algebra, which roughly speaking has size 1/2 of this one,
mm-hmm.
should have a deformation. And that deformation is the master chiral algebra that should be essentially this master chiral algebra Dennis talked about for level zero. So it's probably not clear how to do it for generic level, but for level zero, it should be, that master chiral algebra should be somehow quantization of this 1/2 of this. Another relation.
So is it just O of X?
Is it, who is just who is O of X?
O of X, the chiral algebra.
I don't know. No, I don't.
Wait, just because it looks, this looks like a home of something. So that's something.
No, I mean it's kind of.
I want to say, it could be just X of Z, because then the vacuum model of X of Z would be O of X of X curly brackets of Z, square brackets of Z.
Well, I don't know. Okay, maybe
not. I'm not sure.
Okay,